the background of the general and overall victories. This, of course, was unimportant. Here we begin to distinguish bit by bit among the defendants, who up to this point had talked very much like one another. Their age differential also divided them with respect to probity. Those close to 60 and older made statements that aroused a friendly, sympathetic reaction. But 43-year-old Ramzin and Larichev and 39-year-old Ochkin, the same one who had denounced Glavtop, the main fuels committee, in 1921, were glib and shameless. And all the major testimony about the Prom Party and intervention comes from them. Ramzin was the kind of person, as a result of his early and extraordinary successes, who was shunned by the entire engineering profession, and he endured it. At the trial, he caught Krylenko's hints on the wing and volunteered precise statements. All the charges were founded on Ramzin's recollections. He possessed such self-control and force that he might very well have conducted plenipotentiary talks in Paris about intervention, on assignment from the GPU, obviously. Ochkin, too, was a fast climber. At 29, he had already possessed the unlimited trust of the Council of Labour and Defence and the Council of People's Commissars. One couldn't say the same about 62-year-old Professor Charnovsky. Anonymous students had persecuted him in the Wall newspapers. After 23 years of lecturing, he had been summoned to a general students' meeting to give an account of his work. He hadn't gone. And in 1921, Professor Kalinikov had headed an open struggle against the Soviet government, specifically a professor's strike. What it amounted to was this. Back in the days of the Stolypin repression, the Moscow Higher Technical School had won academic autonomy, including the right to fill important posts, elect a rector, etc. In 1921, the professors in this school had re-elected Kalinikov to a new term as rector, but the People's Commissariat didn't want him there and had designated its own candidate. However, the professors went on strike and were supported by the students. At that time, there were no truly proletarian students, and Kalinikov was rector for a whole year despite the wishes of the Soviet government. It was only in 1922 that they had wrung the neck of that autonomy, and even then, in all probability, not without arrests. Fedotov was 66 years old, and he had been a factory engineer 11 years longer than the whole lifespan of the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party, from which the Soviet Communist Party had sprung. He had worked at all the spinning mills and textile factories in Russia. How hateful such people are, and how desirable it is to get rid of them as quickly as possible. In 1905, he had left his position as the director of the Morozov textile firm and the high salary which went with it, because he preferred to attend the red funerals which followed the caskets of the workers killed by the Cossacks. And now he was ill, had poor eyesight, and was too weak to leave home at night, even to go to the theatre. And such people organized intervention and economic ruin? Charnovsky had not had any free evenings for many years because he had been so busy with his teaching and with developing new sciences, such as the science of the organization of production and the scientific principles of rationalization. I recall from my own childhood the engineering professors of those years, and that's exactly what they were like. Their evenings were given up to their students at all levels, and they didn't get home to their families until 11 p.m. After all, at the beginning of the five-year plan, there were only 30,000 of them for the whole country. They were all strained to the breaking point. And it was these people who were supposed to have contrived a crisis, to have spied in exchange for handouts. Ramzin uttered just one honest phrase during the whole trial. The path of wrecking is alien to the inner structure of engineering. Throughout the trial, Krylenko forced the defendants to concede apologetically that they were scarcely conversant with or were illiterate in politics. After all, politics is much more difficult and much loftier than some kind of metallurgy or turbine design. In politics, your head won't help you, nor will your education. Come on, answer me. What was your attitude toward the October Revolution when it happened? Skeptical. In other words, immediately hostile. Why? 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 Krylenko hounded them with his theoretical questions, and as a result of simple human slips of the tongue inconsistent with their assigned roles, the nucleus of the truth is disclosed to us as to what really had taken place and from what the entire bubble had been blown. What the engineers had first seen in the October coup d'etat was ruin, and for 3 years there had truly been ruin and nothing else. Beyond that, they had seen the loss of even the most elementary freedoms, and these freedoms never returned. How then could engineers not have wanted a democratic republic? How could engineers accept the dictatorship of the workers, the dictatorship of their subordinates in industry, so little skilled or trained and comprehending neither the physical nor the economic laws of production, but now occupying the top positions from which they supervise the engineers? Why shouldn't the engineers have considered it more natural for the structure of society to be headed by those who could intelligently direct its activity? And, excepting only the question of the moral leadership of society, is not this precisely where all social cybernetics is leading today? Is it not true that professional politicians are boils on the neck of society that prevent it from turning its head and moving its arms? And why shouldn't engineers have political views? After all, politics is not even a science, but is an empirical area not susceptible to description by any mathematical apparatus. Furthermore, it is an area subject to human egotism and blind passion. Even in the trial, Charnovsky speaks out, "Politics must, nonetheless, be guided to some degree by the findings of technology." The wild pressures of war communism could only sicken the engineers. An engineer cannot participate in irrationality, and until 1920 the majority of them did nothing, even though they were barbarically impoverished. When NEP, the new economic policy, got underway, the engineers willingly went back to work. They accepted NEP as an indication that the government had come to its senses. But alas, conditions were not what they had been. The engineers were looked on as a socially suspicious element that did not even have the right to provide an education for its own children. Engineers were paid immeasurably low salaries in proportion to their contribution to production. But while their superiors demanded successes in production from them and discipline, they were deprived of the authority to impose this discipline. Any worker could not only refuse to carry out the instructions of an engineer, but could insult and even strike him and go unpunished. And as a representative of the ruling class, the worker was always right in such a case. Krylenko objects. "Do you remember the Oldenburger trial?" In other words, how we, so to speak, defended him. Fedotov. "Yes. He had to lose his life in order to attract some attention to the predicament of the engineer." Krylenko, disappointed. "Well, that was not how the matter was put." Fedotov. "He died, and he was not the only one to die. He died voluntarily, and many others were killed." Krylenko was silent. That meant it was true. Leaf through the Oldenburger trial again and just imagine the persecution. And with the additional final line, "many others were killed." So it was that the engineer was to blame for everything, even when he had done nothing wrong. But if he actually had made a real mistake, and after all he was a human being, he would be torn to pieces unless his colleagues could manage to cover things up. For would they value honesty? So the engineers then were forced at times to lie to the party leadership. To restore their authority and prestige, the engineers really had to unite among themselves and help each other out. They were all in danger, but they didn't need any kind of conference, any membership cards to achieve such unity. Like every kind of mutual understanding between intelligent and clear-thinking people, it was attained by a few quiet, even accidental words. No kind of voting was called for. Only narrow minds need resolutions and the party stick. And this was something Stalin could never understand, nor could the interrogators, nor their whole crowd. They had never had any experience of human relationships of that kind. They had never seen anything like that in party history. In any case, that sort of unity had long existed among Russian engineers in their big, illiterate nation of petty tyrants. It had already been tested for several decades. But now a new government had discovered it and become alarmed. Then came 1927, and the rationality of the NEP period went up in smoke, and it turned out that the entire NEP was merely a cynical deceit. Extravagantly unrealistic projections of a super-industrial forward leap had been announced. Impossible plans and tasks had been assigned. In those conditions, what was there for the collective engineering intelligence to do? The engineering leadership of the State Planning Commission and the Supreme Council of the Economy. To submit to insanity. To stay on the sidelines. It would have cost them nothing. One can write any figures one pleases on a piece of paper, but our comrades, our colleagues in actual production, will not be able to fulfill these assignments. And that meant it was necessary to try to introduce some moderation into these plans, to bring them under the control of reason, to eliminate entirely the most outrageous assignments. To create, so to speak, their own State Planning Commission of Engineers in order to correct the stupidities of the leaders. And the most amusing thing was that this was in their interests, the interests of the leaders, too. And in the interests of all industry and of all the people, since ruinous decisions could be avoided and squandered, scattered millions could be picked up from the ground. To defend quality, the heart of technology, amid the general uproar about quantity, planning, and over-planning. And to indoctrinate students with this spirit. That's what it was, the thin, delicate fabric of the truth. That is what it really was. But to utter such thoughts aloud in 1930 meant being shot, and yet it was still too little and too invisible to arouse the wrath of the mob. It was therefore necessary to reprocess the silent and redeeming collusion of the engineers into crude wrecking and intervention. Thus, in the picture they substituted, we nonetheless caught a fleshless and fruitless vision of the truth. The work of the stage director began to fall apart. Fedotov had already blurted out something about sleepless nights during the 8 months of his imprisonment, and about some important official of the GPU who had recently shaken his hand. So there must have been a deal. You play your roles, and the GPU will carry out its promises. And even the witnesses, though their role was incomparably less important, began to get confused. Krylenko, did you participate in this group? Witness Kirpotenko. Two or three times when questions of intervention were being considered. And that was just what was needed. Krylenko, encouragingly. Go on. Kirpotenko. A pause. Other than that, nothing is known. Krylenko urges him on, tries to give him his cue again. Kirpotenko, stupidly. Other than intervention, nothing is known to me. Then, when there was an actual confrontation with Kuprianov, the facts no longer jibed. Krylenko got angry and he shouted at the inept prisoners. Then you just have to fix things so you come up with the same answers. And in the recess, behind the scenes, everything was once more brought up to snuff. All the defendants were once again nervously awaiting their cues. And Krylenko prompted all eight of them at once. The émigré industrialists had published an article abroad to the effect that they had held no talks at all with Ramzin and Larichev, and knew nothing whatever about any prom party, and that the testimony of the witnesses had in all likelihood been forced from them by torture. Well, what are you going to say to that? Good Lord! How outraged the defendants were! They clamoured for the floor without waiting their turns. What had become of that weary calm with which they had humiliated themselves and their colleagues for 7 days? Boiling indignation at those émigrés burst from them. They demanded permission to send a written declaration to the newspapers in defence of GPU methods. Now, wasn't that an embellishment? Wasn't that a jewel? And Ramzin declared, our presence here is sufficient proof that we were not subjected to tortures and torments. And what, pray tell, would be the use of tortures that made it impossible for the defendants to appear in court? And Fedotov, Imprisonment did me good, and not only me. I even feel better in prison than in freedom. And Archkin. Me too. I feel better too. It was out of sheer generosity that Krylenko and Vyshinsky declined their offer of a collective declaration. They certainly would have written one, and they certainly would have signed it. But maybe someone had some lingering suspicions still. Well, in that case, Comrade Krylenko vouchsafed them a flash of his brilliant logic. If we should admit even for one second that these people were telling untruths, then why were they arrested, and why did they all at once start babbling their heads off? Now that is the power of logic for you. For 1,000 years, prosecutors and accusers had never even imagined that the fact of arrest might in itself be a proof of guilt. If the defendants were innocent, then why had they been arrested? And once they had been arrested, that meant they were guilty. And indeed, why had they started babbling away? The question of torture we discard, but let us put the question psychologically. Why did they confess? And I ask you, what else could they have done? Well, how true, how psychological. If you ever served time in that institution, just recollect, what else was there to do? Ivanov Razumnik wrote that in 1938 he was imprisoned in the same cell in the Butyrki as Krylenko, and that Krylenko's place in the cell was under the board bunks. I can picture that vividly, since I have crawled there myself. The bunks were so low that the only way one could crawl along the dirty asphalt floor was flat on one's stomach, but newcomers could never adapt and would try to crawl on all fours. They would manage to get their heads under, but their rear ends would be left sticking out. And it is my opinion that the Supreme Prosecutor had a particularly difficult time adapting, and I imagine that his rear end, not yet grown thin, used to stick out there for the greater glory of Soviet justice. Sinful person that I am, I visualize with malice that rear end sticking out there, and through the whole long description of these trials, it somehow gives me solace. Yes, the prosecutor expounded, continuing along the same line, if all this about tortures was true, then it was impossible to understand what could have induced all the defendants to confess unanimously and in chorus, without any arguments and deviations. Just where could such colossal collusion have been carried out? After all, they had no chance to communicate with each other during the interrogation period. Several pages further along, a witness who survived will tell us where. Now it is not for me to tell the reader, but for the reader to tell me just what the notorious riddle of the Moscow trials of the 30s consisted of. At first people were astounded at the Promparty trial, and then that riddle was transferred to the trials of the party leaders. After all, they didn't put on trial in open court the 2,000 who had been dragged into it, or even 200 or 300. But only 8 people. It is not as hard as all that to direct a chorus of 8, and as for his choices, Krylenko was free to choose from thousands over a period of 2 years. Palchinsky had not been broken, but had been shot, and posthumously named the leader of the Promparty, which is what he was called in the testimony, even though no word of his survived. And they had hoped to beat what they wanted out of Krennikov, and Krennikov didn't yield to them either. Therefore, he appeared just once in the record, in a footnote in small type. Krennikov died during the course of his interrogation. The small type you are using is for fools, but we at least know, and we will write it in double-sized letters, tortured to death during interrogation. He, too, was posthumously named a leader of the Promparty, but there wasn't one least little fact from him, not one tiny piece of testimony in the general chorus, not one. Because he did not give even one. And then all at once Ramzin appeared. He was a find. What energy and what a grasp. And he was ready to do anything in order to live. And what talent. He had been arrested only at the end of the summer, just before the trial, really. And he not only managed to enter fully into his role, but it seemed as though he had written the whole play. He had absorbed a whole mountain of interrelated material, and he could serve it up spick and span, any name at all, any fact at all. And sometimes he manifested the languid ornateness of a bigwig scientist. The activity of the prompt party was so widespread that even in the course of an 11-day trial there is no opportunity to disclose it in total detail. In other words, go on and look for it, look further. I am firmly convinced that a small anti-Soviet stratum still exists in engineering circles. Go get 'em, go get 'em, grab some more. And how capable he was. He knew that it was a riddle, and that a riddle must be given an artistic explanation. And, unfeeling as a stick of wood, he found then and there within himself the traits of the Russian criminal for whom purification lay in public recantation before all the people. Ramzin has been undeservedly neglected in Russian memories. In my view, he fully deserved to become the prototype of a cynical and dazzling traitor, the Bengal fire of betrayal. He wasn't the only such villain of this epoch, but he was certainly a prominent case. So what it comes down to is that all Krylenko and the GPU had to do was select the right people. But the risk was small. Goods spoiled in interrogation could always be sent off to the grave, and whoever managed to get through both the frying pan and the fire could always be given medical treatment and be fattened up and put on public trial. So then, where is the riddle? How they were worked over? Very simply, do you want to live? And even those who don't care about themselves care about their children or grandchildren. Do you understand that it takes absolutely no effort to have you shot without your ever leaving the courtyards of the GPU? And there was no doubt whatever about that. Whoever hadn't yet learned it would be given a course in being ground down by the Lubyanka. But it is useful both for you and for us to have you act out a certain drama, the text for which you, as specialists, are going to write yourselves, and we, as prosecutors, are going to learn by heart, and we will try to remember the technical terms. Krylenko sometimes made mistakes during the trial. He said freight car axle instead of locomotive axle. It will be unpleasant to perform, and you will feel ashamed, but you just have to suffer through it. After all, it is better to live. And what assurance have we that you won't shoot us afterward? Why should we take vengeance on you? You are excellent specialists, and you have not committed any crimes, and we value you. Look at how many wrecking trials there have been. You'll see that no one who behaved has been shot. Mercy for the defendants who cooperated in one trial was an important prerequisite for the success of the next. And hope was transmitted via this chain right up to Zinoviev and Kamenev themselves. But the understanding is that you have to carry out all our conditions to the very last. The trial must work for the good of socialist society. And the defendants would fulfill all the conditions. Thus they served up all the subtlety of engineers' intellectual opposition as dirty wrecking on a level low enough to be comprehensible to the last illiterate in the country. But they had not yet descended to the level of ground glass in the food of the workers. The prosecutors had not yet thought that one up. A further theme was ideological motivation. Had they begun to wreck? It was the result of a hostile motivation. And now they jointly collaborated in confessing? It was once again the result of ideological motivation, for they had been converted, in prison, by the blazing blast furnace face of the third year of the five-year plan. Although in their last words they begged for their lives, that wasn't the main thing for them. Fedotov, there is no forgiveness for us. The prosecutor is right. The main thing for these strange defendants right at that moment on the threshold of death was to convince the people and the whole world of the infallibility and far-sightedness of the Soviet government. Ramzin, in particular, glorified the revolutionary consciousness of the proletarian masses and their leaders, who had been able to find immeasurably more dependable paths of economic policy than the scientists, and who had calculated the tempos of economic growth rate far more correctly. And then, I had come to understand it was necessary to make a jump ahead, and that it was necessary to make a leap forward. And that is how they were talking here in the Soviet Union, in our own country, in 1930, when Mao Tse-tung was still a stripling. that it was necessary to capture by storm, etc., etc. And Larachev declared, "The Soviet Union is invincible against the weakening capitalist world." And Kalinnikov, "The dictatorship of the proletariat is an inevitable necessity." And further, "The interests of the people and the interests of the Soviet government merge into one purposeful whole." Yes, and in addition, in the countryside, "The general line of the party, the destruction of the kulaks, is correct." They had time, while awaiting execution, to deliver themselves of judgments about everything, and the repenting intellectuals even had enough voice for such a prophecy as this. "In proportion to the development of society, individual life is going to become more circumscribed. Collective will is the highest form." Thus it was that with 8-horse traction all the goals of the trial were attained. 1. All the shortages in the country, including famine, cold, lack of clothing, chaos, and obvious stupidities, were blamed on the engineer wreckers. 2. The people were terrified by the threat of imminent intervention from abroad and therefore prepared for new sacrifices. 3. Leftist circles in the West were warned of the intrigues of their governments. 4. The solidarity of the engineers was destroyed. All the intelligentsia was given a good scare and left divided within itself. And so that there should be no doubt about it, this purpose of the trial was once more clearly proclaimed by Ramzin. "I would like to see that, in consequence of the present trial of the Prompt Party, the dark and shameful past of the entire intelligentsia will be buried once and for all." Larachev joined in. "This caste must be destroyed. There is not and there cannot be loyalty among engineers." And Otchkin, too. "The intelligentsia is some kind of mush. As the state accuser has said, it has no backbone, and this constitutes unconditional spinelessness. How immeasurably superior is the sensitivity of the proletariat." For some reason, the main thing about the proletariat is always, believe it or not, sensitivity. Always via the nostrils. So now, just why should such diligent collaborators be shot? And that was the way the history of our intelligentsia has been written for decades. From the anathema of 1920, the reader will remember, "Not the brains of the nation, but shit," and "The ally of the black generals," and "The hired agent of imperialism," right up to the anathema of 1930. So, should anyone be surprised that the word intelligentsia got established here in Russia as a term of abuse? That is how the public trials were manufactured. Stalin's searching mind had once and for all attained its ideal. Those blunderheads Hitler and Goebbels would come to envy it and rush into their shameful failure with the burning of the Reichstag. The standard had been set, and now it could be retained perennially and performed over again every season, according to the wishes of the chief producer. And in fact, the chief wanted another within 3 months. The rehearsal time was very short, but that was all right. Come and see the show. Only in our theatre. A premiere. M. The Case of the All-Union Bureau of the Mensheviks, March 1st to 9th, 1931. The case was heard by a special assize of the Supreme Court, the presiding judge in this case, for some reason, being N.M. Shvernik. Otherwise, everyone was in his proper place. Antonov Saratovsky, Krylenko, and his assistant, Rodzinski. The producers were sure of themselves, for after all the subject wasn't technical, but was party material, ordinary stuff. So they brought 14 defendants onto the stage. And it all went off not just smoothly, but brilliantly. I was 12 at the time. For 3 years I had been attentively reading everything about politics on the enormous pages of Izvestia. I read the stenographic records of these two trials line by line. In the Prompt Party case, I had already felt in my boyish heart superfluity, falsehood, fabrication. But at least there were spectacular stage sets. Universal intervention, the paralysis of all industry, the distribution of ministerial portfolios. In the trial of the Mensheviks, all the same stage sets were brought out, but they were more pallid, and the actors spoke their lines without enthusiasm, and the whole performance was a yawning bore, an inept, tired repetition. Could it be that Stalin felt this, too, through his rhinoceros hide? How else can one explain his calling off the case of the Working Peasants' Party after it had already been prepared, or why there were no more trials for several years? It would be boring to base our interpretations once again on the stenographic record. In any case, I have fresher evidence from one of the principal defendants in this case, Mikhail Petrovich Yakubovich. At the present moment, his petition for rehabilitation, exposing all the dirty work which went on, has filtered through to Samizdat, our saviour, and people are reading it just as it happened. He was refused rehabilitation. After all, the case in which he was tried had entered the golden tables of our history. After all, one cannot take back even one stone, because the entire building might collapse. Thus it is that MPY still has his conviction on his record. However, for his consolation, he has been granted a personal pension for his revolutionary activity. What monstrosities exist in our country? His story offers material proof and explanation of the whole chain of Moscow trials of the 30s. How was the non-existent Union Bureau created? The GPU had been given an assignment. They had been told to prove that the Mensheviks had adroitly wormed their way into and seized many important government jobs for counter-revolutionary purposes. The genuine situation did not jibe with this plan. There were no real Mensheviks in important posts, but then there were no real Mensheviks on trial either. True, they say V.K. Ikov actually was a member of the quiet, do-nothing, illegal Moscow Bureau of the Mensheviks, but they didn't know that at the trial. He was processed in the second echelon and received a mere 8. The GPU had its own design. 2 from the Supreme Council of the Economy, 2 from the People's Commissariat of Trade, 2 from the State Bank, 1 from the Central Union of Consumer Cooperatives, 1 from the State Planning Commission. What a boring and unoriginal plan. Back in 1920, they had ordered in the matter of the Tactical Center that it include 2 from the Union of Rebirth, 2 from the Council of Public Figures, 2 from this and that, etc. Therefore, they picked the individuals who suited them on the basis of their positions, and whether they were Mensheviks or not depended on whether one believed rumors. Some who got caught this way were not Mensheviks at all, but directives had been given to consider them Mensheviks. The genuine political views of those accused did not interest the GPU in the least. Not all the defendants even knew each other, and they raked in Menshevik witnesses, too, wherever they could find them. One was Kuzma A. Gvozdev, a man whose fate was bitter. This was the same Gvozdev who had been chairman of the workers' group in the War Industry Committee, and whom the Tsarist government, in an excess of stupidity, had arrested in 1916, and the February Revolution had made Minister of Labour. Gvozdev became one of the martyr long-termers of Gulag. I do not know how many years he had been imprisoned before 1930, but from 1930 on he was in prison continuously, and my friends knew him in Spassk camp in Kazakhstan as late as 1952. All the witnesses, without exception, were later given prison terms too. Ramzin testified prolifically and obligingly at this trial also. But the GPU pinned its hopes on the principal defendant, Vladimir Gustavovich Groman, with the idea that he would help work up this case and be amnestied in return, and on the provocateur Petunin. I am basing all this on Yakubovich's report. Let us now introduce M.P. Yakubovich. He had begun his revolutionary activities so early that he had not even finished the gymnasium. In March 1917, he was already chairman of the Smolensk Soviet. Impelled by the strength of his convictions, which continued to lead him on, he became a strong and successful orator. At the Congress of the Western Front, he impetuously called those journalists who were demanding that the war continue enemies of the people. And this was in April 1917. He was nearly hauled from the rostrum, and he apologized, but thereafter in his speech he maneuvered so adroitly and so won over his listeners that at the end he called them enemies of the people again, and this time to stormy applause. He was elected to the delegation sent to the Petrograd Soviet, and hardly had he arrived there than, with the informality of those days, he was named to the military commission of the Petrograd Soviet. There he exerted a strong influence on the appointment of army commissars, and in the end he became an army commissar on the southwestern front and personally arrested Denikin in Vinnytsia after the Kornilov revolt, and regretted very much indeed, during the trial as well, that he had not shot him on the spot. He is not to be confused with Colonel Yakubovich of the General Staff, who, at the same time and the same meetings, represented the War Ministry. Clear-eyed, always sincere, and always completely absorbed in his own ideas, whether they were right or wrong, he was counted as, and was, one of the younger members of the Menshevik Party. This did not prevent him, however, from presenting his own projects to the Menshevik leadership with boldness and passion, such as, in the spring of 1917, proposing the formation of a social democratic government, or in 1919 recommending that the Mensheviks enter the Comintern. Dan and the others invariably rejected all his plans and their variations, and quite condescendingly for that matter. In July 1917 he was very pained by the action of the Socialist Petrograd Soviet in approving the provisional government's calling up army units for use against other socialists, considering it a fatal error even though the other socialists were using armed force. Hardly had the October coup taken place than Yakubovich proposed to his party that it should support the Bolsheviks wholeheartedly and work to improve the state structure they were creating. In the upshot, he was finally ostracized by Martov, and by 1920 he had left the ranks of the Mensheviks once and for all, convinced that he could not get them to follow the Bolsheviks' path. I have gone into all this detail to make it quite clear that throughout the revolution, Yakubovich had been not a Menshevik, but a Bolshevik, and one who was entirely sincere and disinterested. In 1920, he was still one of the Smolensk food supply commissars, and the only one of them who was not a Bolshevik. He was even honored by the People's Commissariat of Food Supply as the best. He claims that he got along without reprisals against the peasantry, but I do not know whether or not this is true. At his trial, he did, however, recall that he had organized anti-speculation detachments. In the 20s, he had edited the Torgovaya Gazeta, the trade gazette, and had occupied other important posts. He had been arrested in 1930 when just such Mensheviks as he, who had wormed their way in, were to be rounded up in accordance with the GPU plans. He had immediately been called in for questioning by Krylenko, who, earlier and always, as the reader already knows, was organizing the chaos of the preliminary inquiry into efficient interrogation. It turned out that they knew one another very well, for in the years between the first trials, Krylenko had gone to that very Smolensk province to improve food requisition work. And here is what Krylenko now said. "Mikhail Petrovich, I am going to talk to you frankly. I consider you a communist." His words encouraged Yakubovich and raised his spirits greatly. "I have no doubt of your innocence, but it is our party duty, yours and mine, to carry out this trial." Krylenko had gotten his orders from Stalin, and Yakubovich was all a-tremble for the sake of the cause, like a zealous horse rushing into the horse collar. "I beg you to help me in every possible way and to assist the interrogation. And in case of unforeseen difficulties during the trial, at the most difficult moments, I will ask the chairman of the court to give you the floor." And Yakubovich promised. Conscious of his duty, he promised. Indeed, the Soviet government had never before given him such a responsible assignment. And thus there was not the slightest need even to touch Yakubovich during the interrogation. But that was too subtle for the GPU. Like everyone else, Yakubovich was handed over to the butcher interrogators, and they gave him the full treatment, the freezing punishment cell, the hot box, beating his genitals. They tortured him so intensively that Yakubovich and his fellow defendant Abraham Ginsburg opened their veins in desperation. After they had received medical attention,
They were no longer tortured and beaten.
Instead, the only thing to which they were subjected was 2 weeks of sleeplessness. Yakubovich says, "Just to be allowed to sleep, neither conscience nor honor matters any longer." And then they were confronted with others who had already given in and who urged them to confess to utter nonsense. And the interrogator himself, Alexei Alexeyevich Nasedkin, said, I know, none of this actually happened, but they insist on it." On one occasion, when Yakubovich had been summoned to interrogation, he found there a prisoner who had been tortured. The interrogator smiled ironically. "Moisei Isaevich Teitelbaum begs you to take him into your anti-Soviet organization. You can speak as freely as you please. I am going out for a while." He went out. Teitelbaum really did beg. "Comrade Yakubovich, I beg you, please take me into your Union Bureau of Mensheviks. They are accusing me of taking bribes from foreign firms and threatening me with execution. But I would rather die a counter-revolutionary than a common criminal." It was likelier that they had promised him that as a counter-revolutionary he wouldn't be shot. And he wasn't wrong, either. They gave him a juvenile prison term, a fiver. The GPU was so short on Mensheviks they had to recruit defendants from volunteers. And after all, Teitelbaum was being groomed for an important role. Communication with the Mensheviks abroad and with the Second International. But they honorably kept the deal they had made with him, a fiver. And with the interrogator's approval, Yakubovich accepted Teitelbaum as a member of the Union Bureau. Several days before the trial began, the first organizing session of the Union Bureau of the Mensheviks convened in the office of the senior interrogator, Dmitry Matveyevich Dmitriev, so as to coordinate things and so that each should understand his own role better. That's how the Central Committee of the Prom Party convened, too. That's where the defendants could have met, to answer Krylenko's earlier leading question. But such a mountain of falsehood had been piled up that it was too much to absorb in one session, and the participants got things mixed up, couldn't master it in one rehearsal, and were called together a second time. What did Yakubovich feel as he went into the trial? Should he not, in revenge for all the tortures to which he had been subjected, for all the falsehood shoved into his breast, create a sensational scandal and startle the world? But still. 1. To do so would be to stab the Soviet government in the back. It would be to negate his entire purpose in life, everything he had lived for, the whole path he had taken to extricate himself from mistaken Menshevism, and become a right-minded Bolshevik. 2. After a scandal like that, they wouldn't just allow him to die, they wouldn't just shoot him. They would torture him again, but this time out of vengeance, and drive him insane. But his body had already been exhausted by tortures. Where could he find the moral strength to endure new ones? Where could he unearth the required heroism? I wrote down his arguments as his heated words rang out, this being a most extraordinary chance to get, so to speak, a posthumous explanation from a participant in such a trial. And I find that it is altogether as though Bukharin or Rykov were explaining their reasons for their own mysterious submissiveness at their trials. Theirs were the same sincerity and honesty, the same devotion to the party, the same human weakness, the same lack of the moral strength needed to fight back, because they had no individual position. And at the trial, Yakubovich not only repeated obediently all the grey mass of lies which constituted the upper limit of Stalin's imagination, and the imagination of his apprentices and his tormented defendants, but he also played out his inspired role as he had promised Krylenko. The so-called foreign delegation of the Mensheviks, in essence the entire top level of their central committee, formally dissociated themselves from the defendants in a statement published in Vorwärts. They declared there that the trial was a shameful travesty built on the testimony of provocateurs and unfortunate defendants forced into it by terror, that the overwhelming majority of the defendants had left the party more than 10 years earlier and had never returned, and that absurdly large sums of money were referred to at the trial, representing more than the party had ever disposed of. And Krylenko, having read the article, asked Schwernick to permit the defendants to reply. The same kind of pulling all strings at once he had resorted to at the trial of the Promparty. They all spoke up, and they all defended the methods of the GPU against the Menshevik Central Committee. But what does Yakubovich remember today about his reply and his last speech? He recalls that he not only spoke as befitted his promise to Krylenko, but that instead of simply getting to his feet, he was seized and lifted up, like a chip on a wave, by a surge of anger and oratory. Anger against whom? After having learned what torture meant, and attempting suicide and coming close to death more than once, he was at this point in a real, honest-to-God rage. But not at the prosecutor or the GPU. Oh, no. At the foreign delegation of the Mensheviks. Now, there's a psychological switch for you. There they sat, unscrupulous and smug, in security and comfort, for even the poverty of emigre life was, of course, comfort in comparison with the Lubyanka. And how could they refuse to pity those who were on trial, their torture and suffering? How could they so impudently dissociate themselves from them and deliver these unfortunates over to their fate? The reply Yakubovich delivered was powerful, and the people who had cooked up the trial were delighted. Even when he was describing this in 1967, Yakubovich shook with rage at the foreign delegation, at their betrayal, their repudiation, their treason to the socialist revolution, exactly as he had reproached them in 1917. I did not have the stenographic record of the trial at the time. Later I found it and was astonished. Yakubovich's memory, so precise in every little detail, every date, every name, had in this instance betrayed him. He had, after all, said at the trial that the foreign delegation, on orders from the Second International, had instructed them to carry out wrecking activities. He no longer remembered this. The foreign Menshevik statement was neither unscrupulous nor smug. They had indeed pitied the unfortunate victims of the trial, but did point out that they had not been Mensheviks for a long time, which was quite true. What was it, then, that made Yakubovich so unalterably and sincerely angry? And exactly how could the foreign delegation not have consigned the defendants to their fate? We like to take our anger out on those who are weaker, those who cannot answer. It is a human trait, and somehow the arguments to prove we are right appear out of nowhere. Krylenko said in his summation for the prosecution that Yakubovich was a fanatic advocate of counter-revolutionary ideas and demanded, therefore, that he be shot. And Yakubovich that day felt a tear of gratitude roll down his cheek, and he feels it still to this day, after having dragged his way through many camps and detention prisons. Even today he is grateful to Krylenko for not humiliating him, for not insulting him, for not ridiculing him as a defendant, and for calling him correctly a fanatic advocate, even of an idea contrary to his real one, and for demanding simple, noble execution for him that would put an end to all his sufferings. In his final statement, Yakubovich agreed with Krylenko himself. "The crimes to which I have confessed," he endowed with great significance his success in hitting on the expression, "to which I have confessed." Anyone who understood would realize that he meant, "not those which I committed." "Deserve the highest measure of punishment, and I do not ask any forgiveness. I do not ask that my life be spared." Beside him on the defendant's bench, Groman got excited. "You are insane. You have to consider your comrades. You don't have the right." Now, wasn't he a find for the prosecutor? And can one still say the trials of 1936 to 1938 are unexplained? Was it not through this trial that Stalin came to understand and believe that he could readily round up all his loud-mouth enemies and get them organized for just such a performance as this? And may my compassionate reader now have mercy on me. Until now my pen sped on, untrembling, my heart didn't skip a beat, and we slipped along unconcerned, because for these 15 years we have been firmly protected either by legal revolutionality or else by revolutionary legality. But from now on things will be painful, as the reader will recollect, as we have had explained to us dozens of times, beginning with Khrushchev. From approximately 1934, violations of Leninist norms of legality began. And how are we to enter this abyss of illegality now? How are we to drag our way along yet another bitter stretch of the road? However, these trials which follow were, because of the fame of the defendants, a cynosure for the whole world. They did not escape the attention of the public. They were written about, they were interpreted, and they will be interpreted again and again. It is for us merely to touch lightly on their riddle. Let us make one qualification, though not a big one. The published stenographic records did not coincide completely with what was said at the trials. One writer, who received an entrance pass, they were given out only to selected individuals, took running notes and subsequently discovered these differences. All the correspondents also noted the snag with Krestinsky, which made a recess necessary in order to get him back on the track of his assigned testimony. Here is how I picture it. Before the trial, a chart was set up for emergencies. In the first column was the name of the defendant. In the second, the method to be used during the recess if he should depart from his text during the open trial. In the third column, the name of the Czechist responsible for applying the indicated method. So, if Krestinsky departed from his text, then who would come on the run and what that person would do had already been arranged. But the inaccuracies of the stenographic record do not change or lighten the picture. Dumbfounded, the world watched three plays in a row, three wide-ranging and expensive dramatic productions, in which the powerful leaders of the fearless Communist Party, who had turned the entire world upside down and terrified it, now marched forth like doleful, obedient goats, and bleated out everything they had been ordered to, vomited all over themselves, cringingly abased themselves and their convictions, and confessed crimes they could not in any wise have committed. This was unprecedented in remembered history. It was particularly astonishing in contrast with the recent Leipzig trial of Dimitrov. Dimitrov had answered the Nazi judges like a roaring lion, and immediately afterward his comrades in Moscow, members of that same unyielding cohort which had made the whole world tremble, and the greatest of them at that, those who had been called the Leninist Guard, came before the judges drenched in their own urine. And even though much appears to have been clarified since then, with particular success by Arthur Koestler, the riddle continues to circulate as durably as ever. People have speculated about a Tibetan potion that deprives a man of his will, and about the use of hypnosis. Such explanations must by no means be rejected. If the NKVD possessed such methods, clearly there were no moral rules to prevent resorting to them. Why not weaken or muddle the will? And it is a known fact that in the 20s some leading hypnotists gave up their careers and entered the service of the GPU. It is also reliably known that in the 30s a school for hypnotists existed in the NKVD. Kamenev's wife was allowed to visit her husband before his trial and found him not himself, his reactions retarded. And she managed to communicate this to others before she herself was arrested. But why was neither Palchinsky nor Krennikov broken by the Tibetan potion or hypnosis? The fact is that an explanation on a higher psychological plane is called for. One misunderstanding in particular results from the image of these men as old revolutionaries who had not trembled in Tsarist dungeons, seasoned, tried and true, hardened, etc., fighters. But there is a plain and simple mistake here. These defendants were not those old revolutionaries. They had acquired that glory by inheritance from and association with the Narodniks, the SRs, and the anarchists. They were the ones, the bomb-throwers and the conspirators, who had known hard labor imprisonment and real prison terms. But even they had never in their lives experienced a genuinely merciless interrogation, because such a thing did not exist at all in Tsarist Russia. And these others, the Bolshevik defendants at the treason trials, had never known either interrogation or real prison terms. The Bolsheviks had never been sentenced to special dungeons, any Sakhalin, any special hard labor in Yakutsk. It is well known that Dzerzhinsky had the hardest time of them all, that he had spent all his life in prisons. But according to our yardstick, he had served just a normal tenor, just a simple 10-ruble bill, like any ordinary collective farmer in our time. True, included in that tenor were 3 years in the hard labor central prison, but that is nothing special either. The party leaders who were the defendants in the trials of 1936 to 1938 had, in their revolutionary pasts, known short, easy imprisonment, short periods in exile, and had never even had a whiff of hard labor. Bukharin had many petty arrests on his record, but they amounted to nothing. Apparently he was never imprisoned anywhere for a whole year at a time, and he had just a wee bit of exile on Onega. All the information here comes from Volume 41 of the Granat Encyclopedia, in which either autobiographical or reliable biographical essays on the leaders of the Russian Communist Party, Bolsheviks, are collected. Kamenev, despite long years of propaganda work and travel to all the cities of Russia, spent only 2 years in prison and 1.5 years in exile. In our time, even 16-year-old kids got 5 right off. Zinoviev, believe it or not, never spent as much as 3 months in prison. He never received even 1 sentence. In comparison with the ordinary natives of our archipelago, they were all callow youths. They didn't know what prison was like. Rykov and I.N. Smirnov had been arrested several times and had been imprisoned for 5 years. But somehow they went through prison very easily, and they either escaped from exile without any trouble at all, or were released because of an amnesty. Until they were arrested and imprisoned in the Lubyanka, they hadn't the slightest idea what a real prison was, nor what the jaws of unjust interrogation were like. There is no basis for assuming that if Trotsky had fallen into those jaws, he would have conducted himself with any less self-abasement, or that his resistance would have proved stronger than theirs. He had had no occasion to prove it. He, too, had known only easy imprisonment, no serious interrogations, and a mere 2 years of exile in Ust-Kut. The terror Trotsky inspired as chairman of the Revolutionary Military Council was something he acquired very cheaply, and does not at all demonstrate any true strength of character or courage. Those who have condemned many others to be shot often wilt at the prospect of their own death. The two kinds of toughness are not connected. And as for Radek, he was a plain provocateur. And he wasn't the only one in these 3 trials. And Yagoda was an inveterate, habitual criminal. This murderer of millions simply could not imagine that his superior murderer, up top, would not at the last moment stand up for him and protect him, just as though Stalin had been sitting right there in the hall. Yagoda confidently and insistently begged him directly for mercy. "I appeal to you. For you I built 2 great canals." And a witness reports that at just that moment a match flared in the shadows behind a window on the 2nd floor of the hall, apparently behind a muslin curtain, and while it lasted, the outline of a pipe could be seen. Whoever has been in Bakhchisarai may remember that oriental trick. The 2nd-floor windows in the Hall of Sessions of the State Council are covered with iron sheets pierced by small holes, and behind them is an unlit gallery. It is never possible to guess down in the hall itself whether someone is up there or not. The Khan remained invisible, and the council always met as if in his presence. Given Stalin's out-and-out Oriental character, I can readily believe that he watched the comedies in that October hall. I cannot imagine that he would have denied himself this spectacle, this satisfaction. And, after all, our entire failure to understand derives from our belief in the unusual nature of these people. We do not, after all, where ordinary confessions signed by ordinary citizens are concerned, find their reasons for denouncing themselves and others so fulsomely baffling? We accept it as something we understand. A human being is weak. A human being gives in. But we consider Bukharin, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Pyatokov, I.N. Smirnov to be supermen to begin with. And, in essence, our failure to understand is due to that fact alone. True, the directors of this dramatic production seem to have had a harder task in selecting the performers than they'd had in the earlier trials of the engineers. In those trials they had 40 barrels to pick from, so to speak, whereas here the available troop was small. Everyone knew who the chief performers were, and the audience wanted to see them in the roles, and them only. Yet there was a choice. The most far-sighted and determined of those who were doomed did not allow themselves to be arrested. They committed suicide first. Skripnik, Tomsky, Gamarnik. It was the ones who wanted to live who allowed themselves to be arrested, and one could certainly braid a rope from the ones who wanted to live. But even among them, some behaved differently during the interrogations, realized what was happening, turned stubborn, and died silently, but at least not shamefully. For some reason, they did not, after all, put on public trial at Rutsutak, Postyshev, Yanukidze, Chubar, Kosior, and for that matter, Krylenko himself, even though their names would have embellished the trials. They put on trial the most compliant. A selection was made, after all. The men selected were drawn from a lower order, but on the other hand, the moustached producer knew each of them very well. He also knew that on the whole they were weaklings, and he knew one by one the particular weaknesses of each. Therein lay his dark and special talent, his main psychological bent and his life's achievement, to see people's weaknesses on the lowest plane of being. And the man who seems, in the perspective of time, to have embodied the highest and brightest intelligence of all the disgraced and executed leaders, and to whom Arthur Koestler apparently dedicated his talented inquiry, was N.I. Bukharin. Stalin saw through him, too, at that lowest stratum at which the human being unites with the earth, and Stalin held him in a long death grip, playing with him as a cat plays with a mouse, letting him go just a little, and then catching him again. Bukharin wrote every last word of our entire existing, in other words, non-existent, constitution, which is so beautiful to listen to. And he flew about up there, just below the clouds, and thought that he had outplayed Koba, that he had thrust a constitution on him that would compel him to relax the dictatorship. And at that very moment, he himself had already been caught in those jaws. Bukharin did not like Kamenev and Zinoviev, and way back, when they had first been tried after the murder of Kirov, he had said to people close to him, "Well, so what? That's the kind of people they were. Maybe there was something to it." That was the classic formula of the Philistine in those years. There was probably something to it. In our country, they don't arrest people for nothing. And that was said in 1935 by the leading theoretician of the party. He spent the period of the second trial of Kamenev and Zinoviev in the summer of 1936 hunting in the Tian Shan, and knew nothing about it. He came down from the mountains to Frunze, and there he read that the death sentence had been imposed on both men, and read the newspaper articles which made clear what annihilating testimony they had given against him. But did he hasten to stop that act of repression, and did he protest to the party that something monstrous is being done? No, all he did was send Koba a telegram asking him to postpone the execution of Kamenev and Zinoviev, so that he, Bukharin, could get there to confront them and prove himself innocent. It was too late. Koba had enough of the sworn testimony. Why did he need living confrontations? However, they still didn't arrest Bukharin for a long time. He lost his job as editor-in-chief of Izvestia, and all his other party assignments and jobs, and he lived for half a year in his Kremlin apartment, in the Poteshny Palace of Peter the Great, as if in prison. However, in the autumn he used to go to his dacha, and the Kremlin guards would salute him as though nothing at all had changed. No one visited him or phoned him any longer, and all during these months he wrote endless letters. "Dear Koba, dear Koba, dear Koba." And he got not one reply. He was still trying to establish friendly contact with Stalin. And dear Koba, squinting, was already staging rehearsals. For many long years, Koba had been holding tryouts for various roles, and he knew that Bukharchik would play his part beautifully. He had, after all, already renounced those of his pupils and supporters who had been arrested and exiled, they were few in number in any case, and had allowed them to be destroyed. The only one he defended was Yefim Tsaitlin, but not for long. He had stood by and allowed his own line of thinking to be wiped out and pilloried before it was fully developed and born. And more recently, while he was still editor-in-chief of Izvestia and a member of the Politburo, he had accepted as legal the execution of Kamenev and Zinoviev. Neither at the top of his lungs nor even in a whisper had he expressed any indignation over that, and yet these had all been tryouts for his own future role. Way back in the past, when Stalin had threatened to expel him, and all the rest of them, from the party, Bukharin, like all the rest, had renounced his views in order to remain in the party, and that, too, had been a tryout for his role. If that was how they acted while still in freedom and still at the height of honour and power, then they could certainly be depended on to follow the script of the play faultlessly when their body, their food, and their sleep were in the hands of the Lubyanka prompters. And what did Bukharin fear most in those months before his arrest? It is reliably known that above all he feared expulsion from the party, being deprived of the party, being left alive but outside the party. And Dyakoba had played magnificently on this trait of his, as he had with them all, from the very moment he had himself become the party. Bukharin, like all the rest of them, did not have his own individual point of view. They didn't have their own genuine ideology of opposition, on the strength of which they could step aside and on which they could take their stand. Before they became an opposition, Stalin declared them to be one, and by this move he rendered them powerless. And all their efforts were directed towards staying in the party, and toward not harming the party at the same time. These added up to too many different obligations for them to be independent. In essence, Bukharin had been allotted the starring role, and nothing was to be overlooked or abridged in the producer's work with him, in the working of time on him, and in his own getting used to the role, even sending him to Europe the previous winter to acquire manuscripts by Marx had been essential, not just superficially for the sake of the whole network of accusations about his establishing contacts, but so that the aimless freedom of life on tour might all the more insistently demand his return to the main stage. And now, beneath black thunderclouds of accusations, came the long, the interminable state of non-arrest, of exhausting housebound lethargy, which ground down the willpower of the victim even more effectively than the direct pressure of the Lubyanka. Nor would the Lubyanka run away either. It too would last for a year. On one occasion, Bukharin was summoned by Kaganovich, who arranged a confrontation between him and Sokolnikov in the presence of high-ranking Chekists. Sokolnikov gave testimony about the parallel rightist center, parallel, in other words, to that of the Trotskyites, and about Bukharin's underground activity. Kaganovich conducted the interrogation aggressively and then ordered Sokolnikov to be taken away. And he said to Bukharin in a friendly tone, "He lies in his teeth, the whore." Despite that, the newspapers continued to report the indignation of the masses. Bukharin telephoned the Central Committee. Bukharin wrote letters, beginning, "Dear Koba," in which he begged that the accusations against him be publicly denied. And then the prosecutor's office published a roundabout declaration. "Objective proofs for the indictment of Bukharin have not been found." Radek telephoned him in the fall, wanting to see him. Bukharin shunned him. "We are both being accused. Why add another cloud?" But their Izvestia country houses were next to each other, and Radek dropped in on him one evening. "No matter what I may say later on, please know that I am not to blame for anything. And anyway, you will come out of it whole. You were not connected with the Trotskyites." And Bukharin believed he would come out of it whole, and that he would not be expelled from the party, for that would be monstrous. In actuality, he had always been hostile to the Trotskyites. They had put themselves outside the party, and look what had come of it. They had to stick together, Even if they made mistakes, they had to stick together on that, too. At the November demonstration, his farewell to Red Square, he and his wife went to the reviewing stand for guests on his newspaper editor's press card. All at once, an armed soldier came up to him. His heart stopped. They were going to do it here? At a time like this? No. The soldier saluted. "Comrade Stalin is surprised at your being here. He asks you to take your place on the mausoleum." And that's the way they tossed him back and forth, from hot to cold, for the entire half year. On December the 5th, they adopted the Bukharin Constitution with fanfare and celebration, and named it the Stalinist Constitution for all eternity. At the December plenum of the Central Committee, they brought in Pyatakov, with his teeth knocked out, and not a bit like himself. Behind his back stood silent Chekists, Yagoda men, and Yagoda, after all, was also being tested and prepared for a role. Pyatakov delivered himself of the most repulsive sort of